the latest on the mounting scrutiny of how Facebook does business.
A company worth more than $500 billion.
Giant Facebook is facing scrutiny this week after
2.7 billion people using it every month.
Harvested data from about 50 million Americans.
The damage to reputation and its integrity is huge.
He took to Facebook and he live streamed what we believe was his attack in the...
But the numbers indicate a colossal company in rude health.
Facebook will hold a company-wide meeting today so employees can ask questions about the unfolding scandal with a political data firm.
Even fines of $5 billion fail to dent the share price.
Documents appear to show that Facebook allowed companies to access information like users' private messages and the names...
And yet many now think it should be broken up.
Facebook says it is, quote, in the process of conducting a comprehensive internal...
Can Facebook survive? This feels like a very modern problem, but we've been here before.
We're really looking, I think, at a phase for Facebook and all the other technology companies, which is a bit like the 50 to 100 years that followed the Industrial Revolution.
Emily Bell is the director of the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University in New York.
You had this enormous innovative disruption in the middle of the 19th century, followed by 50 years of social reform. You had to stop sending kids up chimneys and putting them to work in bakeries. All the really terrible things that had come out of a period of high financial growth and high technological disruption. And we're going to go through that period with technology companies as well.
In the early 20th century, a handful of companies dominated the supply of oil and electricity that was powering the world's industrial growth. Later, the same would happen with telecommunications. And by the turn of the millennium, with computer software. Then the dominance of the largest companies in each of these sectors was stopped, with regulation opening the way for new players to enter the market. Now that dominant position in social media is occupied by Facebook, which makes it a target for the regulators.
There's something incredibly important which buoys Facebook up called network effects. Essentially, the value of a network is the square of its size, meaning the bigger it gets, the more powerful and valuable it becomes.
Carl Miller is research director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at London-based think tank Demos.
Facebook has emerged as a company which, under our current definition of monopoly, certainly isn't one. A monopoly is one which basically has consumer impacts through the changing of price. So if you are large enough to basically be able to control the price of a product in a market, which means consumers have to pay more for it, you're a monopoly. But of course, we pay nothing for Facebook. So it's not even remotely that kind of monopoly. We have to completely redefine the way that monopoly actually works.
And one way Facebook has achieved this dominance is by eliminating competition.
It's impossible for other companies to compete. They'll either buy it or they'll copy whatever that startup has that they doesn't have in order to be able to offer it to far more people than they had before.
And blow that startup out of the water.
Sure. Snapchat's a great example of this, where it was growing really fast. It had all these new features that clearly people enjoyed. So it was simply copied by Facebook and others, those features, and then kind of rolled out within its own platform.
Even some of those who helped create Facebook are now concerned about its impact. Chris Hughes was one of the founders of the company, alongside Mark Zuckerberg.
We haven't had an even mid-sized social network be created since 2011 that's gotten any meaningful success. And it's because Facebook has erected barriers to entry and, when necessary, copied some of the innovations that are out there into the core parts of the Facebook platform. And we have no other alternative social network to go to.
And Emily Bell from Columbia University says this has made the company vulnerable to antitrust regulation, just as happened to those big energy, telecommunications and software monopolies in the past.
the biggest threat to Facebook is probably antitrust regulation. 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, if you'd said the anti-monopoly regulation will come for the platforms, people would just have laughed at you. It felt like such an old-fashioned concept. And yet now, on Capitol Hill, people are sort of discussing this seriously and beginning to think about sort of what data protection will look like and whether or not something like Facebook, which now owns WhatsApp and Instagram, whether or not it should have even been allowed to buy those companies.
We've all become acutely aware of some of the downsides to Facebook's position as the single most dominant communications network on Earth. Something that Chris Hughes thinks we should be very worried about.
It's a bit too easy of a story to say that, oh, they're all evil. Like, these are people I know. I've been friends with them. Mark came to my wedding. I went to his wedding. We have been friends. And I do believe that he is motivated by positive reasons. I also think that he is too powerful. If you remember, the early success around Facebook was because it wasn't open to the world like MySpace was, with everything being done on a public stage, but instead the default was to share with the people who you were friends with, or who at least were a degree or two separated from your real life in-person community. So that was a very different product, a very different company than what it is today. This is how it goes with Facebook. You roll out a product and you highlight the positive usages and you ignore or downplay the negative ones. You know, you talk about something like live casting, and the positive is that people can live cast to all their friends when they're baking a pie or a biscuit or something over the weekend, and you ignore the fact that it can and has been used by terrorists for hideous events, for bullying, for schools, by mass shootings, etc. And then later you apologize and you try to say, well, we're working on it to mitigate the downside risk. This is the playbook. And if regulators, particularly in the US, step up and say Facebook has meaningfully harmed consumers because of its monopoly status, then they have the power to unwind these mergers and change that. The question is whether or not they will.
And it sounds like that's what you'd like to happen.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
When I met Mark Zuckerberg in 2006, the company at that time was incredibly idealistic. The goal of connecting lots of people onto one network seemed like such a great idea. Mark had this vision. He had a belief in it that was so compelling, you could not help but be drawn to him.
Roger McNamee is a Silicon Valley investor who Mark Zuckerberg turned to for help in running what was becoming a fast-growing technology giant.
One of the things that drew me to Facebook was that they required the identity be authenticated via your school email address, right? That was a big breakthrough, because previously all social networks had allowed anonymity, so that trolls and other bad actors could spoil the environment. The second thing he allowed in those early days was that the user had control of who could see what was going on their page. And I thought those two things, identity and privacy, were going to make Facebook magnificently successful and create a really safe, wonderful environment. What I did not realize was that from Mark's point of view, the identity thing was actually an engineering choice that made building their network a lot easier, that he wasn't actually committed to the identity thing on its own terms, and he wasn't even remotely committed to privacy. And in 2010, he famously declared that users have no expectation of privacy on Facebook. I think the notion of trading user privacy for business advantage was locked into the culture of Facebook through to very recently.
What Facebook discovered was the enormous value of its access to its users' data. It could sell this information to a third party, a company wanting to advertise to certain kinds of people, for example, and charge a significant fee for it. Not bad for something it had collected from its users for free.
In about 2008, for the first time, people started to spend 20, 30, 40, even 60 minutes a day on Facebook, which meant that advertising could be much more successful. And that transformed the way Facebook viewed itself. You wanted to go to applications developers and give them access to friends lists. This is the very thing that led to Cambridge Analytica. And the U.S. Federal Trade Commission stepped in 2010 and 2011 and said, I'm sorry, you cannot give corporations access to your users' friend lists without first getting permission from those friends. And Facebook completely ignored the consent decree that they signed in 2011. It's in the company's DNA to resist any kind of control from outside. And when the company finally figured out a monetization strategy, they applied that same ethic, that same laser focus on their own goals and the disregard for criticism, for regulation, and for any kind of external control. It was inevitable that there would be ugly consequences.
Facebook itself doesn't see any problem with the fact that it connects people and at the same time makes money from their data.
Connecting people was the mission then, and it's the mission now.
Chris Norton is the company's Vice President of Communications for Europe, Middle East and Africa.
It's the same business model as ITV. We serve people ads, and we try to serve ads to people that are relevant to them, so that I'm not going to get the ad that a 20-year-old would get because I'm interested in different things. And that's the same as ITV. You know, the ads you get on Love Island are going to be different for the ads you get in This Morning. Our model works exactly the same way, maybe slightly better because we have a bit more information about people.
What do you see and read to serve people ads that are relevant to them?
We see the information that you provide to us. So if you say, I am of this age, I live in this place, I'm interested in these things, I like these pages, that's the information that tells us a bit about you and hopefully enables us to serve you an ad that's relevant to you.
This is what people call the metadata.
It's data that enables us to know a bit about you and serve you an ad that hopefully is relevant. And I think there's nothing wrong with targeted advertising. It should be really good. So we know that you're trying to send me a message and we know that I'm trying to receive that message and we have to have those data points in order to run the service. The message itself we don't see and that is encrypted. But we have to know who you're trying to send it to, otherwise we can't provide the service.
But the problem now is that the company has moved on from being a nice adjunct to our lives, a convenient tool to help us all stay in touch with our friends, to something that has significant influence on real-world events. Emily Bell.
It used to be that things would happen in the real world and you'd see them reflected on social platforms. Now things that happen on social platforms are moving out into the real world, whether that's through elections, whether it's through ethnic conflict, advertising and persuasion. All of those things have changed simply because it's now how most people get their news, how most people communicate.
Carl Miller at Demos agrees.
Almost every societal and political problem that we've ever had has grown a digital dimension. Everything from electoral interference through to how people are trading illegal wildlife online, through to the exploitation of social media platforms by terrorists or by paedophiles, or by just simply banal, tawdry, everyday criminals. Each of these has developed a digital dimension. Every single person that works on any of these issues has suddenly realised that at least the activity that happens on Facebook is the heart of the problem that they're now trying to deal with. And that has meant that they have been absolutely battered and will continue to be battered as Facebook's role in them is made clear.
From the start, Facebook said it was not responsible for the content it published. It was just a platform offering ways for people to connect to one another. What they chose to do with those connections, it said, was none of Facebook's business. But it couldn't hold that position for very long. As more and more examples piled up of people making harmful use of the platform, Facebook began hiring thousands of people to moderate material which was clearly aimed at fueling violence and illegal antisocial activity. But how far has the company really accepted responsibility for the content on its site? Facebook's Chris Norton.
I don't think we're a publisher in the conventional sense. You know, we don't commission the news or the content that goes on our site. We can invest in 30,000 people in order to look at the reports of bad content and take a decision on whether they should come down. I see, you know, the teams of moderators who are looking at content and making sure it goes against or our guidelines and making sure we remove it really quickly. Where we draw those lines about what is allowed and what isn't is really important. Now, if you created the internet now, you actually would let society and democratically elected governments take some views around what is and what isn't acceptable in their country.
Facebook says it's now grappling with huge problems that aren't really its responsibility. But many people believe those issues came with the territory of a business that's built on mining data from our online connections. And the company may say it's changing, but not everyone believes it. Silicon Valley investor Roger McNamee.
I don't believe the company has changed at all. When I went to Mark and to Sheryl Sandberg in the fall of 2016, 9 days prior to the U.S. election, I went as their former mentor and a friend to warn them that I thought there was something about the business model and the algorithms that allowed bad actors to harm innocent people. I spent 3 months pleading with them to recognize that this was an existential threat, that they were a business based on trust, and that they would destroy that trust if they did not make radical changes to the business model and cooperate with authority. It's entirely possible, in fact, likely, that Facebook was not aware of the consequences of its design in 2016. However, there is no doubt by early 2017, they knew precisely what the issues were, and they continued to deny any responsibility. When Mark made his recent blog post in which he talked about end-to-end privacy and cooperating with authorities, that was a monument to misdirection and insincerity.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, Facebook's Chris Norton disagrees.
There's a real shift to wanting to share things, not always publicly. Like, people do still want to share their photos with a large number of people, or share their status update with all their friends. But increasingly, people also want to share stuff in slightly smaller groups, where we can enable more of that to be done incredibly securely. And encryption is part of that. Having more encrypted services where people know the only person who can see what they're sharing is them and the person they're sending it to is an incredibly important part of the future.
Some of Roger McNamee's criticism comes from his view that Facebook has been designed to profit from the things that make us want to share and connect the most: hate and fear.
Facebook have to get you to spend a lot of time to make those ads worthwhile. And the way they do that is they appeal to our flight or fight instinct. We are herd animals, and if we're afraid or outraged, we share our fear or outrage, because when others share those same emotions, we feel better, and we get social credit for being the ones who warn the herd. Now, they're not out there saying we want to promote hate speech or disinformation or conspiracy theories, but the algorithms, they don't pay any attention. They just promote whatever we react to, and we cannot help reacting to hate speech and fear. They did not create terrorism, but they have empowered terrorists. I mean, if you look at what happened in Christchurch with the 51 people who died, the terrorists there played social media, including Facebook Live, like a symphony orchestra. The whole thing was orchestrated ahead of time. He created a group of 1,000 disaffected people who knew he was going to do a terrorist act, who was ready to copy the video and then spread it. This is only possible because the architecture of these platforms is tuned. Their profit margins are enhanced by the worst content out there.
Others, too, are skeptical that Facebook is serious about privacy. Dara O'Brien is a data consultant based in Dublin. He says we've misunderstood the type of data that's really valuable to the company. It's not the content that users post that matters most. It's what's called the metadata. Who is communicating with who? What their preferences are? What websites they then visit, and so on. That's where the real money lies.
That information is actually what drives their advertising model. That's what allows the analytics to identify, based on the likes of content, not the content itself, whether someone is a Republican or a Democrat, a Tory or a Labour Party supporter, or in favour of Leave or Remain. It's not the content, it is the metadata that's valuable. And in this privacy model that Mark Zuckerberg has promoted, Facebook are still going to have that metadata. And that gives an incredibly deep and granular snapshot of who you are, what you like, without them needing to have any detail behind that.
Dara is closely following a number of lawsuits that are currently being brought against Facebook, alongside some other technology giants. These are being led by the Irish Data Protection Commission, and they're being seen as an important early test of a new EU-wide regulation called GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, which has been designed to protect the data privacy of all EU citizens. Is this an existential threat for the company? Do you think it's going to blow their business model out of the water?
Yes. We can see how significant a threat it is with the recent announcement from Mark Zuckerberg that Facebook is going to try and move to a more privacy-based model. That's a tacit recognition that the requirements of legislation are a challenge to Facebook's business model.
Do you think it'll affect its business model so much that the company might actually grind to a halt? Or do you think it'll survive this challenge?
I would hope that Facebook as a business would evolve in the same way as we've seen throughout the Industrial Revolution and the Manufacturing Revolution. Companies have evolved their business models to be less polluting. They've evolved their business models to be more corporate social responsibility focused. But in those contexts, the change that was required wasn't always an existential change to the fundamental ethos of the organization. And Facebook is facing that kind of mindset shift.
Facebook, however, doesn't see it this way. In fact, it seems to be rather a fan of GDPR.
I think it's a really good set of privacy rules, which we have implemented. In fact, we've gone further. We've rolled out GDPR to the rest of the world as well to make sure that they benefit from those GDPR protections. It's the kind of regulation that we need to work with and be held accountable to.
Maybe that's because GDPR is seen by some to tilt the playing field in favour of big companies like Facebook. Martin Sorrell, until recently CEO of the world's largest advertising agency, WPP, and now executive chairman of media company S4 Capital.
GDPR, I think, has created a real problem because it's made the bigger platforms more powerful, because the smaller platforms or those people who were thinking about competing, for example, with Google, Amazon, Facebook in Europe, have said, no, the costs of so doing are so high that we're not going to do it.
However, the European Union Commissioner responsible for implementing the regulation across the EU feels the new rules do have real bite. Vera Jourova believes this regulation can change the way technology titans behave.
When I started to meet the IT sector managers, I asked them always two questions. How will you improve the world which you have spoiled? So at the beginning, they thought that it's my Czech sense of humor, but I meant it seriously. They themselves admitted that they are part of our current problem, so they have to be part of the solution. And the second question was, what do they think is the quickest, whether it's technology, whether it's money, or whether it's law? And I knew that the law will be the third one, always in the past. But then we came with the General Data Protection Regulation, which I think managed to catch up.
Commissioner Jourova says that a sense of trust between a company and its customers still matters in the business world, and that this will force Facebook to respect the way it uses our data.
If the people will not have elementary trust that good things are happening to them in that system, they will be living somewhere else, maybe for some other platforms where the service will reflect better their new needs, which will not contain the negative factors which we now see on Facebook and other platforms.
It's an appealing idea, and it's the way most markets work. But is that likely or even possible? Would users really move to other social media providers if they don't like the way they're being treated by Facebook? Carl Miller of Demos.
We've always supposed that kind of individual consumer activity times a million, times a billion will be the way in which things change. So the reputation gets battered enough, people move to different platforms, they log off for a week, they do things which can hurt a company. They're basically the users go on strike. There's no evidence to suggest that really has in any way made much of a difference to the way in which Facebook has behaved or made much of a difference to how much money it's earned.
Well, part of the problem is, I guess, we go on strike and then a week later we're back on again.
So. Because of the power of the network effects.
But is there an alternative way we could run social media on the internet?
The problem with this Facebook social media is that ultimately it's centralized. All of our information is owned by these giant corporations. We don't really have the control that we would have if we really were the owners.
Larry Sanger is the co-founder of Wikipedia and now the chief information officer of another wiki-based encyclopedia, Everipedia. He sees a solution in introducing a set of open standards in social media that would allow users to move easily between different providers.
Right now, if you want to talk to your friends on Facebook, you have to go to Facebook, you have to use a Facebook app or whatever. What if we could connect with each other directly or via groups of people who are sort of federated together in networks? Wouldn't that basically give us a lot more liberty, but also a lot more security in that the information is then really in our own hands?
If Facebook's stated aim is to link as many people in the world as possible, why are they not doing what you're proposing, which presumably would do that?
They want to make as much money as possible. I'm not at all convinced that ultimately they would be in favor of a system that takes away ultimate control from them.
Because that takes away ultimate profit, you're thinking?
Well, yeah. But I also think that they realize that this is coming down the pike and it's probably inevitable. So if they don't get out front of it, then they're going to be left behind.
This campaign for an alternative model for social media may just be starting, but at its core is a powerful idea that's been used before to deal with technology giants jealous of their own market share and profits. In telecommunications, for example, mobile phone companies, and in software, giants like Microsoft have been forced to accept a degree of interoperability, allowing customers to move easily between providers. Would Facebook support a similar move in social media?
We support what I think you're calling for there, which is data portability. We think it's a really important thing, but it's a really hard thing as well. And it's exactly the kind of area where you need governments and you need regulators to set out clear frameworks. You've got to be clear about what is your data and what isn't. If you have within the data that on Facebook, my birthday, is that your data or is that my data? And should you be allowed to take that somewhere else and put it into a different service? Now, these questions are really important questions. They're quite hard questions. But we think the concept of data portability is a good thing. But we do need regulators and governments to work with us on how you make it happen in practice.
There's data portability and also interoperability. The idea that maybe I'm not on Facebook myself, but I could speak to people on Facebook, I could message them. What's Facebook's feeling about that?
Again, very supportive. It means working not only across our apps and services, but also across the mobile phone networks and text messaging in order to make that happen.
While Facebook may be reluctant to surrender its basic business model, there are signs it realizes it needs to diversify if it's to continue to be successful. The company recently announced the creation of a new digital currency called Libra, which Facebook users could use to send and receive money and make online purchases. It's doing this in partnership with several other technology giants, but the driving force behind the project appears to be Facebook itself. Analysts can see why. Carl Miller.
It would give Facebook an amazing view, which allows them to link what people talk about, what their interests are, with what they actually buy. And if you are an advertising agency, I cannot think of a more valuable body of data in the entire world that you would ever wish for in 100 different Christmases than that.
It may be an advertiser's dream, but some people who've been close to the company are alarmed. Silicon Valley investor Roger McNamee.
Libra is literally an Orwellian vision. If it works, it transforms Facebook and creates essentially a new business model for them that is unaccountable, incredibly stable, and immensely profitable. The interest return just on all of the reserve currency being held there and be staggering. It will undermine currencies like the pound and the dollar and the yen. And, you know, maybe only a little at the beginning, but eventually, if it succeeds by a lot.
And Chris Hughes, one of Facebook's founders, is scathing in his criticism of the idea.
There are questions around the stability of the investments in the currency, around privacy, and how the information around transactions is going to be used. There are a whole host of concerns that Facebook is not necessarily highlighting. I think currencies should be controlled by the central banks that are representative to democratically elected governments and not by multinational corporations.
So is this how Facebook itself sees the Calibra project?
You and I, you know, sitting in the UK, probably have a number of banking apps that enable us to send money pretty easily. There are 1.7 billion people in the world that do not have a bank account, but a billion of those have a mobile phone. So the functionality that we have today to send money could be applied to those 1.7 billion people.
Many commentators are saying they're a bit concerned about the safety of people's financial data. And the other is about Facebook's potential influence over currency movements, spending patterns on a global basis.
It will only work if it has regulatory approval and scrutiny. And if it doesn't, then it won't work.
In many ways, the troubles of the last 3 years were inevitable for Facebook. It started as a way of just connecting people. But thanks to its sheer size and the growing centrality of the internet in our lives, it became something very different. So is it reasonable to expect it to have foreseen the consequences of its rapid growth? Carl Miller.
Facebook has grown faster than its understanding of what its impact on society is. I don't think they had any idea of the transformative nature of what they were creating. I think they're privately probably terrified by what's happened. Too much of our time has been spent worrying and debating about whether the tech giants are moral or not, when we have to realise was that we've created a world where there are serious fundamental systemic clashes of incentives between what companies need and between what society needs. That's the bigger, deeper problem.
Others are far less sympathetic. Roger McNamee.
They're treating us as a source of fuel. We're not the customer, we're not the product, we're the fuel source. And they're just out there monetizing this data at the society level, manipulating behavior at the society level. And how you would allocate that is beyond me. It might be more effective to tax the profits at, say, 90% on targeted advertising and then recycle it into things that were valuable for society, like transportation or education or healthcare. That might make sense. But again, I would rather just end the practices by eliminating the use of our data.
Talk of taxes brings up the question, where is government in all of this? At the start, scared of throttling a nascent industry that promised to help stimulate economic growth, and very much behind the curve in understanding the technology, governments did very little to regulate companies like Facebook. And that hands-off approach has largely continued, with states putting the onus on Facebook to police itself. For Columbia University's Emily Bell, this has had serious consequences.
One of the things they're doing at the moment is just changing this design of how we communicate again. So they are driving people into ephemeral stories, which is where you post picture after picture on Instagram or picture after picture on Facebook, and then it all disappears. And they are really growing their private messaging business. If you're a journalist or you're an academic and you want to see what's happening to the way that humans communicate, the idea that everything will be ephemeral and private, yet still be able to, you know, scale into these huge networks, that's just as troubling and terrifying.
Because we won't be able to see how WhatsApp groups are influencing politics, for example.
Yeah, for instance, in the Indian election, where WhatsApp is really sort of the key communications platform, the BJP, the ruling party there, set up thousands of separate WhatsApp groups, which it could address small numbers of people in. And if it was addressing a rural community, it would have a completely different message to an urban community. Well, if you think about, you know, the importance of being able to interrogate policies and campaigning messages, that's a complete nightmare. You know, we're really moving into a post-broadcast era for all of this stuff. And we haven't really begun to think about what it means for us to have shared facts and shared information, which all arrives, you know, at the same time.
And it may be that its size proves to be Facebook's biggest challenge. Economic logic suggests that any company worth $500 billion and rising will be around for a long time yet. But if it fails to find a way to tame the demons unleashed by global social media, it could well find itself facing the same fate as other dominant providers of essential services in the past, the Standard Oil or AT&T of its day. Many think Facebook is too big to be allowed to fail, but perhaps it's becoming too big to be allowed to survive. Martin Sorrell.
The fundamental issue for Facebook is whether they continue, maybe even at a more rapid rate, to adjust to the criticism and focus. I think that's the key vulnerability. If the management of the company is easy to say from outside, is responsive and proactive, not just reactive, then I think they will be okay. But if they are stiff about it, if they're fixated with the history and they don't change, then I think they will have a problem.
These last 3 years have awoken Facebook to the fact that what it does is intensely, intrinsically political. And, ironically in the eyes of some, it's using that new sense of itself to resist being broken up. Chris Norton.
We can make investments in technology and people that we couldn't do if we were broken up. And so by being together, we can invest in 30,000 people to make sure that we're keeping our platform safe. We can invest in AI technology that will spot bad content and remove it before anybody sees it. And we can do that because we have some scale.
A plea not just for survival, but for Facebook to prosper. But can it be allowed to continue with its founder's philosophy, so memorably captured in the slogan, "Move fast and break things"?
We don't move fast and break things anymore. We actually changed "move fast and break things" to "move fast and build stable infrastructure," but it's just not quite as catchy. One thing we've actually done is slow down, because there's amazing good that can be done through Facebook and through social media, you know, people raising money or raising awareness for causes. But we've also got to spend as much time worrying about the minority, but still some of the bad stuff that can happen, and making sure we tackle that. So it's not a case of moving fast, it's a case of moving safely.
Facebook says it's ready to take on a bigger sense of responsibility. The big question, though, is whether or not it can adapt its business model to this new world, where we're all very concerned about how our data is used. The company certainly does feel too big to fail. But as more human activity moves online, the demands we're now placing on it are changing fast. Paradoxically, to survive, Facebook may need to become much more nimble, moving fast again to avoid being broken itself.